Today is Tuesday, and coming up, we're going to talk about the aftermath of the Santee shootings. The opinions expressed on this show are not necessarily those of the regents of the University of California, nor the management of KUCI.
Show your stomach if you can. Eat the rim. Pull a good chance of a power up back to shame. Swearing out the power of when y'all move to play. And I'm tired of living it now. Best you can go. Eat the rim. Yum, yum, yeah. Eat the rim. Yum, yum, yeah. Chemicals in your food. Eat the ribs. Yum, yum, yeah. Don't you think that's rude? Oh, eat the ribs. Yum, yum, yeah.
With us on the show today, we are two critics of social policy, I guess. And with us is Tim Wise, who is raising the issue of the race in a race of the shooters and the victims in this case. And also with us is Mike Mills, a criminologist who graduated from UC Irvine and is now researching crime. So welcome to the show.
Thanks.
Tim, yeah. What is your basic position on the kind of the aftermath of this Santee shooting?
Well, for the last 3 or 4 years, really, ever going back at least to the Springfield shooting in Oregon with Kip Kinkle, I've been writing a number of articles essentially talking about the way that when white people, whether they're young kids who shoot up their schools or serial killers or any number of crimes that are disproportionately being committed by white people, whenever those folks do even the most dastardly of deeds, no one really discusses it as a racial thing, that no one says, well, what's wrong with white children? What's wrong with white families? And of course, I'm not suggesting there's something about being white that makes one do any of this per se, but I think it's fair to say, and I've been saying now for a number of years and repeat after Santee, that if these children who were shooting up these schools were all black children, I have very little doubt that people would be noticing that, talking about that, asking what's wrong with the black family, et cetera, and really racializing this deviance and this kind of crime. So the point that I was really trying to make was that we're being very hypocritical and really was trying to get to the heart of the issue of racial profiling, that our stereotypes of danger, our stereotypes of crime and deviance and dysfunction tend to be, in the white community that is, tend to be images of black and brown people, black and Latino youth in particular. And what these shootings indicate for us is that one is not necessarily safe just because one gets away from black and brown people in the city and moves to the suburbs, or what the mayor of Santee calls an all-American town, because indeed these kinds of things do happen there. In fact, when it comes to these mass shootings, they pretty much all happen in all-American towns.
But are you saying that white kids are to blame?
In the most literal sense, it has been white kids doing this. Now, am I saying that there's something about being white that is to blame? No, absolutely not, although there might be something about growing up in a white, suburban, middle class or usually above affluent culture that might be certainly to blame. But I'm not suggesting that there's something about whiteness as some genetic or inherent cultural defect. What I am suggesting is that in these cases, these kids have been white, and yet the media, whenever you hear them say what the similarities are in the shootings, they say, well, they're all boys. They all use guns. They all played video games. And I'm sure there are others. I'm sure they all ate Cheerios at some point in their life, but that's not really the point. The point is, if all these kids had been black, if all these kids had been Latino, if these kids had all been people of color, we would be discussing this as a racial thing, and white people all around the country would be asking about the social pathology of black people, and they'd be using it as an argument against integration in these suburban schools if these, in fact, had been black kids. So I just think we're operating on a double standard, and I just thought it was worthwhile to point that out.
What do you think about that, Mike?
I agree. I agree 100%. I think that we have had a kind of killing in this country that's been ignored, even though it's quite spectacular. It's not that the media doesn't report on it. It's that, as Tim said, it's not racialized in the same sense that we're seeing inner-city shootings or homicide rates in the inner city racialized. We have probably, I think the New York Times survey found over the last 40 years, 25 to 35 mass shootings in this country every year. Almost all of them are committed by middle class or more affluent men, which is overwhelmingly white. Most of the shooters are middle-aged, but a few are teenagers or young adults, and a few are elderly. But the thing that they have in common, as Tim said, is they're almost all white. They're almost all from middle class or upper backgrounds, very generally suburban backgrounds. We have a lot of these in California. And there has not been the same kind of concern focused on these in terms of what are the causal factors. We assume they're individual. In the case of an inner city shooting, we assume there's something wrong with, I guess if you're liberal, you say something wrong with poverty status, and if you're a conservative, you say there's something wrong with the culture of poverty and morals and so forth. But for white shooters, we have said they're individuals with problems. That's the big problem. Or they're kids with problems.
How about the argument that these kids were picked on?
Yeah.
Shooters.
Yeah, they are, and that's very interesting because that argument always comes up and there's always vows to do something about it. Picking on is the thing that the mainstream society does. And there's always talk about, wasn't it awful, but you know, when you look at who gets blamed and who gets punished, in the Santee shooting, for instance, it was the shooter's friends. They were the ones that were told to stay home from school. The administration not only did that, but went public with the fact that they were literally being blamed and punished for this, while the popular kids who picked on them were nothing happened to them at all.
Yeah, isn't it weird? Because I saw the news coverage that day and the next morning, and the reporters were egging these friends of the kid on, the Santee shooter, and saying, don't you feel guilty? Don't you feel guilty that you didn't stop him?
Right.
You know, isn't that kind of, really kind of laying a guilt trip on these people?
Oh, yeah, and they didn't go to any of the cheerleaders and jocks and say, didn't you feel guilty about picking on this kid who was half your size and new to the school and obviously had some emotional problems. It's amazing to me, and this has happened in most of the school shootings, that the hierarchy, the mainstream values, and it's not just of schools but of culture itself, because the administration firmly sides with the popular kids and the jocks and all of this. This is the sorting process, the winners and the losers, and so there's a reluctance to criticize the mainstream values that underlay a lot of this bullying that not only this kid but a lot of kids put up with in schools and throughout society.
Yeah, but do you think, people say that these guys were, these shooters, that, you know, when this guy particularly, when he lived in Maryland, people picked on him, said he was gay, said he was, you know, talked with a squeaky voice, he was tiny, you know. I mean, how do you stop that?
How do you stop that?
Yeah.
Well, I think, first of all, it's much harder to stop than simply focusing on the school. During the 1990s, we saw considerable national bullying of unpopular groups. We certainly see that in California, of immigrants, of certain racial groups, of gay people. These welfare mothers, at one time or another, and certainly all the time, these groups are blamed for causing the problems in society. So bullying is a national attitude, and it is conducted by people who have power to bully. And I think that's why, even though intellectually we deplore it, there's very little done about it.
But in California, for instance, there's this new law supposedly saying that you can't, you know, act in a discriminatory way towards kids or act homophobic or whatever like that.
Yeah, so, I mean, for schools?
It's for schools, yeah. There's some kind of new legislation that Governor Gray signed and stuff.
Right, and of course they can do that in the legislature in Sacramento. They can continue to be homophobic, and 62% of the voters can continue to be homophobic. We find it very easy to focus on a problem that happens in a school because youth are another element in our society that don't have any power, and they're fairly easy to scapegoat. So
if I could jump in here.
Yeah,
also,
go ahead.
It's interesting, you know, when we talk about being picked on, I don't want to minimize that because clearly it's horrible for anyone to be, mentally or emotionally tortured in those years, which are, you know, tough enough as it is when you're growing up in a society, that an adult society that doesn't really value, as I know Mike is fully aware of and has written about much, doesn't really value young people very often. But what is interesting, you mentioned the issue of gay and lesbian kids. I mean, talk about people who were picked on.
Right.
You know, gay and lesbian kids all around this country are picked on repeatedly and harassed in the most horrific way, and yet they are not the ones who are picking up guns and going out and killing everybody. Now, what I think is interesting, then, is that to say it's merely I was harassed, I was picked on, I think there's something very specific about being picked on and being a member of the dominant race, the dominant sexual orientation, the dominant class status, the dominant gender, that is particularly difficult for people who fit into all these dominant groups to all of a sudden find themselves being, quote-unquote, picked on. Black kids get picked on. Jesus, you know, people of color are picked on, and, I mean, that's even minimizing what it is. And yet, again, they're not the ones who decide, gee, I think I'll go shoot 30 people or I'll build a bomb and blow up my entire school. So I think what's going on is that in a lot of these communities, these quote-unquote, all-American, you know, very heterosexist, middle class and above, white cultural communities, the centerpiece of your, you know, existence in that community is often the high school when you're a kid. The centerpiece of your existence is fitting in with this very typical norm. Now, if you're gay or lesbian, you already know you don't fit in with that typical norm. I mean, you know that you are oftentimes looked at as a pariah. If you're a person of color, you already know that you don't fit into that norm, and you build up certain defense mechanisms to deal with the fact that you are not the dominant group. But when you're a member of those dominant groups, you basically don't develop the same defense mechanisms. You don't develop the same coping mechanisms, and frankly, you have a skin that is a lot thinner in many ways than a lot of the folks. I'm not trying to, you know, glorify or romanticize oppression. I'm certainly not trying to romanticize being a member of an oppressed or discriminated against group, but I think there's something to say for the fact that when you are subjected to some type of social stigma on the basis of class, of race, of gender, sexual orientation, that the defense mechanisms and the coping skills that you have to learn in order to survive often would be the things that would prevent you from going off like this, whereas the kids who don't, you know, really ever have to build up those mechanisms and have something of a sense of entitlement in a way of being accepted have the hardest time coping when they're not accepted.
But there's also this availability of weapons from adults. I mean, the kids don't have guns.
Right.
They get it from somewhere.
Oh, of course. Of course. And yeah, I mean, and there's no question that that has, I mean, something, you know, certainly something to do with it. And the lack of, you know, parental supervision or parental care in terms of where weapons are stored, I think probably is a much greater problem in these communities, for the simple reason that in these communities, again, there's a false sense of security that somehow, you know, my child's not going to steal a gun and go kill anybody. I've taught my child gun safety, or, you know, we're in a safe community. No one's going to break into our house and steal our gun. But if you were in the city and you had a gun, and of course, actually, gun ownership rates are lower usually in urban areas among people of color, but if you had a gun in a community of color, let's say a poor neighborhood, you would surely make sure that it wasn't just sitting out on a table, you know, or in some, you know, some cabinet that was unlocked, because you know that, you know, somebody could easily break in. You have a higher, you know, rate of people breaking into, you know, home invasions, and somebody could steal your gun. You're going to be a lot more careful. I've lived in New Orleans for 10 years and worked with folks in urban communities that were heavily black, and those who owned guns, and most did not, but those who did were especially careful about where they had those guns and access that their children would have to them, because they knew that the risk of that gun being stolen in a burglary was too high, and so they just they were much more careful. And people that I knew in the more white suburbs, you know, were very cavalier about their guns.
You know, it's really interesting, Mike, especially, don't you think it's interesting that when the school authorities banned these friends of the alleged shooter from going to school the rest of the quarter, I guess, don't you think that that is kind of strange? Because it seems to me that they use the argument that they were trying to protect them.
Yeah.
So usually, a lot of times when they act, you know, in a repressive manner, they always say it's for your protection.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And it was not only strange, it was cruel. It was an extremely cruel thing to do.
Right, especially when they lost, you know, all these other friends, too.
Yeah, they basically publicly, and also they went public with it. This is another thing that just exacerbated the cruelty.
Yeah, discipline usually is secret for juveniles.
Well,
in school, usually.
It is, unless there's a political purpose for them. And I thought it was absolutely appalling that they did this. And in a sense, what the administration was saying, even if their justification was for the safety of these students, they're saying, we cannot control the violent tendencies of the students that might want to do something to these kids.
Uh-huh.
You know, we're not going to take responsibility for that. When, in a sense, the kids who were the bullies, I would think, are equally culpable, if not more culpable. If we're going to blame somebody besides the shooter, then I think I would look second to the people who bullied him. And also to a lot of the factors that Tim's talking about. But if we're just looking in an individual sense here. So I thought the administration basically did exactly what will uphold the situation that caused the problem in the first place, was that the idea that we have hierarchies, and the hierarchies are allowed to bully members that they, non-members that they view as losers. And as we know, and as Tim said, with particular kids, and there are very few who actually snap and shoot a bunch of people, but for the particular kids that this is going to be the most dangerous for, that's absolutely the worst thing they can do. I mean, the administration basically said the only problem we had was these geek kids. That's it.
How about this, the idea that kids don't want to snitch on each other, so they didn't, you know, they patted him down, they looked for the weapon, but they didn't find it, but they didn't tell an adult. I mean, how is that's very common, I guess.
Well, I can think of lots of times I haven't turned in people over certain incidents where if something had happened later, people would be pointing the camera at me and saying, why didn't you do that? I mean, this goes on throughout society. Doctors are notorious for not turning in their colleagues that actually have killed people, you know, due to malpractice. Yeah. So this is, you know, again, it's a media search for a villain. And they're making something very simple out of the fact that a lot of kids do not have any reason to trust the judgment or response of the administration. Their whole life has been that it's not just other kids that are bullying them, but the administration is the one in Santee has shown, and also Columbine and some other schools, is firmly on the side of the jocks that are doing the bullying. They're even deputizing the jocks and the popular kids to go after these unpopular kids and report them, and saying we can't guarantee the safety of these unpopular kids on our campus. So there's no reason for these kids to trust authority in the first place.
Is it because of the emphasis on sports? I mean, a lot of these are, you know, sports brings whatever honor to the school and all this stuff.
Exactly. Yeah, that's one of them. Sports, you know, if you think back about it, all of our high school hierarchies and the hierarchies that exist throughout society, they're just, high school is just kind of the first place you really become aware of them. You know, who's rich, who's popular, who's, you know, who has certain saleable skills like athletics, and so forth. And so high school is really just a reproduction of the society in which the high school exists. And, you know, yeah, I think that the emphasis on sports is one, the emphasis on beauty, the emphasis on wealth, the emphasis on whiteness, you know, the emphasis on heterosexuality, all these things contribute to the fact that we're going to have kids who don't fit into this for whatever reason.
Yeah, and I think it's, to echo Mike, and also just to add this, you know, the idea that these, you know, kids that did not tell what they knew are the ones who are going to be punished, as Mike said, it takes the onus of responsibility away from the administration, as if somehow, you know, the administration never had any inkling that there might ever be a problem with their school. And what was interesting was, in the wake of the shooting, and actually since my article went out over the Internet, I've received about 3,500 emails, including...
3,500, wow,
3,500,
that's a lot.
including probably a couple of hundred from Santee and surrounding communities, both from people of color and also from white folks. And what I'm hearing from quite a few of them, actually, is that, you know, there had been all kinds of rumors flying around the school in the weeks before the shooting that there was going to be some kind of violence, but they thought it was going to be racially motivated. And, of course, it didn't necessarily involve this Andy Williams kid. In fact, I don't think it did at all. But there were all these rumors. It was being talked about. There's no way the administration didn't know about those rumors and what was being said. And so the question then comes up, well, you know, if these rumors are flying around, what was the school doing to try and tame whatever potential conflict might have existed? And I would have to say very little, because if you saw the principal of the school interviewed the day of the shooting, and of course I'm sure she was in a certain degree of shock, so I'll cut some slack, but what was still very interesting was that when they asked her, and I can't remember the context of why they even asked her, but they asked her the question, does your school have much racial diversity or ethnic diversity? And she answered almost like in a horrified tone, oh, no, not at all. You know, like, that would be the worst thing, you know, if we did. You know, in other words, to, I guess, soothe the conscience of the folks at Santee that, you know, your children can still come here because we don't have those people, you know, and I'm sure maybe she didn't mean it that way, but it sure sounded that way, and it leads me to believe that if there were these, you know, considerations of potential racial violence, they weren't doing much to deal with it. And I'm getting, you know, emails from, I actually got emails from kids who had gone to Santana and who had recently transferred to two kids, who had recently transferred to a different high school in the same district, and talked about the cliquishness at Santana and the way that it was completely ignored by teachers, by staff, by administration, the way that kids were repeatedly in front of staff, in front of faculty, in front of administrators, called fag, you know, constantly gay-baited. This was probably more prominent even than the racial component, because there really aren't enough people of color at that school or in that community to make that all that prominent, apparently. But, you know, the homophobia was rampant, and these kids were saying that's one of the reasons that they transferred. I mean, one young man said he just couldn't stand it. He had to get out of there. He thought he was going to snap, you know. It's not, you know, the fish rots from the head down. And to put all of the blame for any of these incidents on the kids who, I mean, I'm not saying that they shouldn't have said something. And like I said in my article that went out, I think had this kid been black, I think if Andy Williams had been black running around saying, I'm going to kill a bunch of people, or if Dylan Klebold and Eric Harris had been black with a website talking about all the white kids and teachers they intended to kill, I'm pretty sure there would have been something done, because we tend to take that as a much more serious threat. But that said, you can't just place the blame on the kids who didn't tell, or that one adult who didn't tell. You have to really ask what was going on at that school that the administration had put up with an atmosphere of intolerance or an atmosphere of harassment for so long.
Well, the media image of Santee, as of Littleton and West Paducah and these other communities where these shootings, these white student shootings, which this is another thing. The only mass shooting we're capable of getting interested in this country anymore on a sustained basis is when a white kid gets killed in a school. But the immediate image of Santee was of this absolutely pristine, invulnerable community, and that there was no violence here. And it's incredible, because there's been several very ugly racial incidents in Santee in the recent past.
Oh.
And there have also been, I've just looked at the violent crime report on the web, and Santee has a considerable amount of violent crime. This is not including homicide. This is not this image that these people had retreated away from the dangers and horrors of the inner city only to find that one of their own kids or their own kids are the big problem. Santee's already got a violent crime problem.
Right.
And suburbs have violent crime problems. Domestic violence is rampant in the suburbs. And so the whole media image of this paradise lost was very offensive, because the media basic statement was, this is a community where things like this aren't supposed to happen. Well, where are they supposed to happen then? What's the implication there? If this happened down in the barrio or in the inner city, that's where they're supposed to happen. And of course, this is where they almost never happen, these kind of mass shootings.
But what should the authorities do? You know, like yesterday in South Orange County, Mike, you've lived down here, which is, you know, pretty white. They actually arrested two kids who supposedly made some threats, and so in two different high schools. What should the authorities do?
Well, I'm afraid that if a kid is dumb enough to make a threat in a school at this point, they better expect a reaction. I mean, I don't know the nature of the threat. It depends on whether it's obviously a joke. I mean, the situation we had here in San Jose at De Anza Community College, where, you know, the student had weapons and bombs already prepared, that's one kind of threat. But the kinds of threats that go on where people say, oh, I'm going to kill my math teacher, you know, if I don't get a better grade, if those kinds of things are pathologized, then obviously this country's going to do nothing else but arrest kids. There's got to be some kind of judgment here about the seriousness of it.
It's like at the airport, you can't, you know, joke about a bomb on the plane.
I think that's the attitude kids ought to take, is this is not a time to be joking about killing people at school. You can probably expect a reaction. So I'm less concerned with authorities responding to threats, to real threats, than I am about the general climate of denial of what it is that causes these problems and these very few kids to snap in the first place.
But I've had, I know kids who, at Fountain Valley, for instance, out here, who did a drawing of a guy with a gun, and then they were kicked off that school.
Right, that's ridiculous.
You know, I mean, that's a free expression. I mean, you can't draw what your life is like or whatever, you know, or your fantasies even.
No, and I'll bet when we look through these kids, we're going to find very few popular kids at the top of the hierarchy, no matter what they say or do, being handled in this way. John Katz wrote a book called Geeks, in which he got a lot of summarized a lot of emails he got from students, and the kids who are punished in this thing are the same kids who are the sort of outcasts in the first place.
So what should what's the solution? what should authorities do?
What
should kids do? Whatever. I mean, what? Yeah.
Well, young people, I mean, clearly, have to be very, very careful. And I think until there has been some pretty significant progress, preemptive progress, not reactive activity, to try and make it very clear and sort of inculcate a different cultural norm within the schools, so that folks are not likely to make idle threats. Until that happens, I think that people need to, you know, it will be sort of the airport mentality that they're not going to be able to expect a threat to be taken lightly. And that's unfortunate because it might mean that certain kids will end up being treated more harshly than they should be. But, you know, for at least a short period of time, that's probably, if threats are made, that's probably how it's going to have to be handled. And it certainly is how it will be handled in most cases, just by the authorities, I have no doubt. As far as what, you know, ultimately, though, is going to have to happen, either to get a handle on the shootings, which, like Mike said, are still quite rare, although obviously any are too many, but more importantly, the sort of atmosphere of harassment and intolerance that leads to, even if it doesn't lead to a single shooting, leads to, you know, unbelievable emotional stress and even physical distress for young people at a time when it's tough enough to be young. There's going to have to be some real serious rethinking about the way that American education is structured. It's going to have to become far less structured on sort of a industrial model of you know, input and output, of basically taking this raw material and turning it out so that it can go, you know, into an industrial economy and get a job that that child is slotted for. I mean, ultimately, right now, our educational system is about processing people for job slots and about essentially replicating a labor market. It's not really about creating citizens. It's not really about engaging people and solving the problems of their community. And increasingly, it's about, you know, whether or not you marked B or C with your number two pencil on a standardized test. And I think any time a school system operates on the basis of processing product and processing raw material instead of trying to really engage people in activities that are meaningful, you're going to have a lot of bored kids, you're going to have a lot of hostile kids, you're going to have a lot of kids who are stressed out about whether or not they got into the honors class, whether or not they're in the popular clique, whether or not, you know, they're in the in crowd. And, you know, until the school creates a different cultural norm of acceptance and inclusion, and more than that, engagement and giving young people something to do other than cram for an AP exam or an SAT, then I think the overall climate is going to be really conducive to some serious, you know, emotional health problems, if not actual violence. So it really means that we have to rethink the way that we organize education, far different than it is right now.
But you almost sound like a conservative. Are you asking for family values to be taught?
No, I'm really talking about something far different than that. I'm talking about really operating schools more along the lines of what Paulo Freire and other radical educators in Brazil and even those in the United States that operated freedom schools in the South in 1964 in Mississippi, for example. They were talking about liberatory education. They were talking about engaging people with their community to overcome problems, getting children, young people involved in actual things as opposed to merely cramming for exams. So am I talking about values? Well, yes, but I'm talking about very much community-minded values, liberatory values, not sort of, you know, harsh and repressive values, which in fact are instilled directly or indirectly by the kind of top-down hierarchical educational system that we have right now.
How come is there a difference between private and parochial schools and public schools? It seems most of these shootings are in public schools, right?
No, we had a couple in private schools.
Oh, we had?
Yeah.
But do you think that maybe in private schools there's more attention to each person? You think there's like that, or?
Well, you have certain advantages. I mean, within the private schools, you're going to have a lot less, you have, you know, lower teacher-pupil ratios. You tend to have very selective criteria for who's able to even come in the door. And, you know, the private schools can easily turn away folks who have genuine attention deficit disorder, not all the folks that have been, you know, over-medicated for the claim that they have ADD. But, I mean, you know, people who have actual physical or emotional disabilities or learning disabilities or come from, you know, quote-unquote disadvantaged or oppressed backgrounds can easily be turned away by private schools. So it's sort of somewhat self-selective. Public schools have to take everybody, and they're going to have folks from really, you know, difficult situations that they're coming from. So naturally, you know, it's quite possible you're going to have more violence. But what's interesting is if you look at some of the data, the actual incidence of fighting, for example, is not really different to any statistically significant degree between private schools and public schools. The percentage of kids who are bringing drugs to campus, who are bringing cigarettes to campus, who are breaking various school rules, and sometimes even bringing weapons, not necessarily guns, but weapons in general, including knives and other things, really is not nearly as different as you would think between public and private schools. So we sort of need to rethink, I think, you know, the stereotype. Maybe things do tend to have more of a tendency to get out of hand in a public school. I would tend to suggest that that has a lot to do with the crowding in that school. When you have these huge buildings with 2,000, 2,500 students in them that were made for 1,200 or 1,300, it's just like any urban area. The studies are very clear that one of the reasons you have higher homicide rates and higher violent crime rates in the cities is precisely because of population density and crowded housing. And so it's, you know, the same principle will operate in a school building.
Here's this has been a fairly pessimistic discussion so far, but here's the part that's puzzling about all of this. I agree with all these factors, and yet we're talking about an institution here, secondary schools in the United States, not even primary, but secondary schools that serve 25 million students. And the most remarkable thing about them, if we look at lethal violence, is how rare it is. I don't know of another institution in our society that could boast a couple of killings a year, and I hate to say boast, but this is the United States, and a couple in an institution that large is really a very low rate. In fact, if we had the same violence, homicide rate throughout society that public schools have, we'd be safer from homicide than Sweden is. So even given all of these factors, it's not that the situation is one where we're seeing armies of kids going berserk. The second thing is that trends have generally been getting better over the last 25 to 30 years. And I'm not suggesting this is because the powers that be in the United States have done positive things. I think it's because there's a certain adaptability on the part of younger people. And two specific instances are, one among white kids, is that the murder rate among white kids has fallen to its lowest level in 1999 since statistics have first been kept 30 years ago in California. The second thing is that some of the most stressed kids in California, of course, are black, and their imprisonment rate, they're the only group, black people under 30, are the only group to show a rapid decrease in imprisonment in California. Black people over 30 show the biggest increase. Black people under 30 show the biggest decrease.
Is that because of three strikes?
No. Three strikes only accounts for a small part of the increase in imprisonment among people over 30. Whites and blacks over 30 are showing the biggest increases. Young people are showing the biggest decreases. And African American youth, when you look at all the factors that occurred in the 1990s, really should have seen a remarkable increase in imprisonment. And I think what has happened is there are certain adaptive factors, and it may have to do with peer culture, it may have to do with community culture, that are countering some of these destructive trends that are being imposed from the top down. And those are things I think we need to look at. And one of them, of course, we generally try to criminalize and demonize them, gang culture or peer culture among white kids. Psychiatrist James Garbarino, who's being quoted by everybody in the press right now, the author of Lost Boys, is blaming internet culture and the dark side. I guess this is kind of a Star Wars analogy that he's using. The dark goth culture, the fact that these kids can get on the internet and reinforce each other's pathologies and then pick up a gun and go to school. I think he's missing a whole lot, as earlier researchers were missing about the value of gangs and peer organization in the inner city, that these can have very valuable factors in reducing distress and violence as well.
That's for sure, yeah. So we're listening to a discussion on the aftermath of Santee shootings. This is Subversity here on KCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. The opinions expressed on this show are not necessarily those of the regents of the University of California, nor the management of this station. The number here is 824-5824-949 area code if you want to chat with our guests, Tim Wise and Mike Mayles. Do you think that these proposals that have been talked about, like putting, you know, security gates or whatever, and, you know, check your people's lockers and check people's bags, have see-through, you know, backpacks and stuff like that. What do you think about those kind of proposed solutions?
Well, unless we're going to do it throughout society, I don't see any particular reason to do it in schools. I mean, the odds of being shot in school are much less than almost anywhere else. In fact, as Vince Schiraldi of the Justice Policy Institute said, if you want to be safe from homicide, run into a school. I think that, you know, look what happened at the state capitol. Another white, a dissed white male, got mad and ran his truck into the side of the state capitol.
Right.
I mean, these kinds of things are very common in the sense of being numerous. It's not that, there's a high statistical probability that an angry white man is going to kill you. But these kinds of random acts where somebody is just mad at the world, as we started out this hour talking about, tend to be concentrated among middle-class and more affluent, mostly white men, are very common in society. They occur probably at the rate of at least every 10 days.
Right.
And go ahead.
I'm sorry.
And not always with a gun. I mean, there's a lot of other instruments that are used to express this rage. And one of the things we have to understand is why this rage is occurring. And applying these kinds of mass controls and mass, you know, like media restrictions or see-through backpacks or locker searches or banning purses, you know, any kind of expression is ridiculous when you're talking about a problem that is highly concentrated in a few individuals and whose causes are not really very well understood.
Right, and in reality, I mean, if you look at a couple of the incidents that are probably considered among the most senseless and just hard to comprehend. One would be Columbine, both for the just the magnitude of it and also the you know complexity of the plot, and also the one in Jonesboro in Arkansas, where you know in the first instance you have somebody who's going to build bombs. I mean, even if there had been metal detectors or security guards, they could have gone the night before, set up bombs all around the school, blown the building up and killed an awful lot of people, and no metal detector would have stopped them. And in Jonesboro, you know, those two kids pulled the fire alarm, got the kids out of the school, into the yard, where they shot them from a grassy area above the school, so that, you know, clearly a metal detector wouldn't have been particularly helpful there either. So the idea that that's going to be a panacea, that that is going to solve the problem, is certainly unproven and not particularly logical. Could it have stopped certain incidents? Well, you know, maybe it could have, but I agree with Mike that in the long run, the potential for, you know, creating sort of a prison environment in that school could create all kinds of other problems that would more than overcompensate for whatever slight potential reduction, and it wouldn't even be causal, it might be, you know, a correlation, could be gained from having things like detectors.
Is there any social science research focusing on these schools that have killings or the perpetrators? For instance, I was thinking of a film that Arthur Dong did called License to Kill, when he actually went out and interviewed murderers of gay people or people suspected of being gay.
Yeah.
And he actually went to prisons and, you know, interviewed these people. And some of the people most freaked out were, could have been, you know, repressed homosexuals, but they had gone through a very religious right kind of education. One guy, a black guy, actually turned out his father was like a preacher or something.
Right.
And so, you know, it seems to me, and he got a lot of flack from the gay community for, you know, doing a film about that, because people don't want to watch, you know, somebody, or one of my friends said, oh, it's like watching a film about Nazis.
Right.
Why would you want to go watch that? But it seems to me that just as the left has to know about the right, you know, what the right is up to, it's you know, we need to understand why people get into these situations.
Well, that's why Alice Miller, a Jew, psychoanalyzed Hitler in retrospect. Yeah. She wanted to know.
But, I mean, but have there been any, I guess there aren't that many cases. I mean, I know that people were trying to do research on the city of Columbine, I think. I mean, Littleton, I mean,
right.
After the incident, because I even got calls about, you know, where you can find, you know, people's phone numbers or whatever in the city, and that kind of stuff. Do you think, I mean, has there been any research on this type of stuff?
One of the problems with doing any research on these incidents is that, even though they've been far too prevalent, if you only have, I mean, let's say if you were to take all the incidents of these mass shootings, either, you know, successfully carried out or maybe foiled at the last minute, if you put them all together, you would have probably, I'm talking about schoolyard attempts or successful murders, you would have somewhere maybe around 30 at the top limit within the last 7, 8, 9 years, okay? And the reality is that when you're dealing with a data set that small, it's going to be pretty tough to come up with truly hard, you know, very statistically valid conclusions. You could come up with something, and you could probably make some inferences, and you might even be, you know, fairly close to the ballpark, because there have been quite a few similarities, but you're dealing with a pretty small data set, so I don't know that you could come up with something really conclusive about the various factors. Now, having said that, I think we could at least come up with certain ideas that might help us in terms of preventive action in dealing with the problems. We do know that if there were very serious attempts in the schools, you know, to do, you know, nonviolence conflict resolution training from the time kids are in elementary school as a way to sort of instill an entirely different set of values in terms of how to deal with conflict, then that would clearly deal with one of the issues that we know is going on, and that is the sort of cliquishness and then the inability to deal with conflict in a constructive and productive way, regardless of you know, what other profile aspects might exist, but it's tough. I mean, the studies that have been done to try and get into the minds of murderers or rapists, even those come to sometimes wildly different conclusions, and that's a huge data set, you know, so you can imagine the difficulty in this kind of stuff. Right.
But Mike, don't you think it's, I mean, you say that these are isolated cases, so maybe there's nothing in common between them.
Well, there's obviously some things in common. I mean, whether they're not things that a whole lot of other people have in common as well. I mean, if we're talking about the picked on white kid, or the picked on white adult, for that matter, who hasn't developed good defenses to deal with anger, then that would probably fit millions of people. And that's the problem. It's not so much the danger of the false negative as the false positive, of roping too many people in with these profiles that they're trying to apply to identify the school shooter. And lo and behold, the profile just happens to be of kids who tend to be unpopular or nonconformist. You know, the sort of thing that we can then encourage hierarchies to pick on some more, which is basically what this is, what our response to it has been about. One of the big differences between the very high murder rates that we see in inner cities, which tend to be crimes involving either individuals who are mad at each other or some other kind of offense, not mass shootings, and the mass shootings that we see more affluent people become involved in, is exactly the fact that the middle class, the mass shooting, is tends to be much rarer, and as Tim said, generates a much lower data set to study. And it's also one I don't think we want to study as much, because I think we're going to come down to the fact that the problem lies not so much with the individual's reaction.
Uh-huh.
A lot of people, I think, wonder, when you think about all the bullying there is in this society, whether it's in the workplace or in schools or throughout, police, whatever, and the various groups that are bullied a great deal more than white people are, as a rule, white and straight people, then the real question is, why isn't there one of these every day? Why doesn't somebody shoot up a school every hour on the hour? I mean, when you think of the millions of people that could do this, why doesn't this happen more often?
So, like, it's that, you know, but you implied that it's adults, you know, that do more of this, right?
And, oh, yeah.
You know, but not everybody is like Mike Douglas going around shooting, you know, up L.A. or whatever.
Oh, right.
I mean, and yet the media seems not to cover, like, when that guy went into a schoolyard and killed, bunch of people, and some of them were non-white, right?
Oh, and Stockton, the Stockton School massacre?
Yeah. I mean, that didn't get that much, you know.
No, it was in and
hysteria.
Out of the news.
Yeah.
And we had the 10th anniversary of the Stockton School massacre, in which a 26-year-old white man shot a bunch of Southeast Asian children, little children, in a schoolyard in Stockton. He killed five and wounded 30. I mean, this was a huge massacre. 10th anniversary occurred right around the time that there was hyper concern in the United States in 1999 over the school shootings, and no one even remembered it because it didn't fit the profile of a school shooting that we really care about. And this is really one of the most amazing things to me, that we are so fixated. On the one hand, it might seem a paradox that we're fixated on mass violence by white kids, not by white adults and not by people of color, but just by white kids. It might seem a paradox. But I think the value is that it allows the media, the experts, the administration, politicians to distance themselves from it. And I know that sounds a little strange because these are white kids after all. But the distancing is involved in several aspects. One is they can rule out poverty and socioeconomic attrition and racism as the cause because it's a white kid from a middle-class community. So we don't have to talk about any of those social failings, those inconvenient social failings. The second thing is we can talk about it as a kid phenomenon, not as an adult phenomenon, even though adults do the same thing for the same reason, and allow ourselves to distance ourselves from the situation and say, the real thing we need to do is have kids come under more adult control, set ourselves up as the saviors, the bearers of the fine values and the salvation for kids. At the same time, we rule out uncomfortable ills like poverty and racism that obviously we have failed as a society to even address, let alone solve. So it's a very convenient kind of shooting for people to focus on, even though it's not common and it's not the worst kinds of killings we have in this country, because it serves so many political ends.
How about the rights of the accused in these cases? the shooter.
What right?
I mean, he's because of Proposition 21?
Right.
That now he's treated as an adult. His picture's all over the world. And, you know, usually with juvenile crime, they don't even know, you know, who did it, right?
Well, I'm afraid if you shoot up a bunch of people in public, your picture's going to be in the paper. I think that's one of the, it goes with that territory.
Yeah, right. Right.
Your privacy is going to take a hit, you know, when you do something like that. So I don't think he was surprised that he's all over the world.
No, no. And sometimes maybe they want, you know, maybe.
Oh,
yeah.
Harrison Klebold and Columbine wanted to be all over the world.
Yeah, yeah.
They made a video, and they want Quentin Tarantino to do a movie about them.
Of course, interestingly, I should point out, they probably won't be doing a movie about the young black kid in Florida who just got sent up for life.
No.
Oh, right.
You know,
right.
At the age of 14 for something he did when he was 12, which, frankly, I can't possibly believe that he intentionally killed this six-year-old. But I'll tell you what, even if somehow one could prove to me that he formed the idea in his mind to do this, we still have to really ask ourselves what kind of, you know, society are we wanting to create where we're going to send 12-year-old kids, you know, away for the rest of their lives and send the message that, that children are irredeemable and then be surprised. You know, James Baldwin had a great quote that I think applies here. He said, you know, you ought not be surprised when the bread that you cast upon the waters floats back to you poisoned. And I think that applies here, that when we're going to treat children as miniature adults, of course, giving them none of the rights of adults, but we're going to expect of them certain types of behavior and certain types of submission to our control, if you will, we really ought not be surprised when people are going to act out. And then, of course, when they do, as the case in this kid in Florida who clearly, you know, did a horrible thing by putting this wrestling move on the six-year-old, but to somehow say that we're going to send that kid away forever, and there's very little sympathy for him among white folks. I mean, I'm getting emails from a lot of black folks who were mentioning that in the wake of my article on Santee, but I'm not getting a whole lot of responses from white people talking about how terrible that is, because I think we look at him and we say, well, that's a potential super predator. That goes right along with the person who says this wasn't supposed to happen here. As Mike mentioned earlier, the subtext of that is, well, it was supposed to happen over there, and right. When it does happen over there, A, we won't be surprised, B, we won't be particularly upset, and C, we'll go on about our business. And I think that when this thing happens in Florida, you know, that's the kind of person who we expect, and you'll actually hear people, if they're being honest, will say things like, you know, well, even if he didn't intend to kill her, he probably would have killed somebody someday. I mean, I hear ignorant comments like that all the time. So, you know, let's just lock him up now. But with Andy Williams, you know, or with Klebold and Harris or any of the folks who do this, we really want to know their motive. Susan Smith drowns her two kids, and everybody wants to know what was going on in her mind. But if, in fact, that had been a black man, as she said, that killed her children, I'm pretty sure we wouldn't have been calling out the psychiatrist to figure out what was going on in his head.
No, that's exactly right. Why are we the only society in the world that thinks this way about kids? I mean, I think we're down to the company of Somalia, which has no central government, in treating kids as really more harshly than we treat adults, in the sense that kids are sentenced to longer terms for the same crime than adults are in California and throughout the United States. And we are willing really to toss away 12-year-olds for life imprisonment and to execute, I believe, Pete Wilson and Cruz Bustamante had an argument over whether we should execute 14 or 13-year-olds,
right.
With the Democrat wanting to execute 13-year-olds. Why are we the only society in the world? No other Western nation looks at it this way, and practically no other third world looks at it this way.
But you're not saying that kids are innocent. I mean, innocence of youth and all that stuff.
No, I never bought that. Kids are reflections of the adult society that raises them. And, I think the childhood innocence argument, in a sense, goes the other way. I think the question is matters of experience. Certainly very, very young children, like three-year-olds, cannot formulate the intent to kill. It's one thing if Hulk Hogan put a bunch of wrestling moves on a six-year-old and killed her. Yeah, I think the guy's pretty guilty.
Right.
He knows. When a 12-year-old who's you know, for all we know, has no idea what his strength is, does something like this, I think we would probably be more forgiving if it was a white adult that did this than a black kid.
Right.
In fact, we have been more forgiving. Child abuse cases, real blatant child abuse cases, rarely result in life imprisonment for the perpetrator.
But, you know, in that field, in this field, child abuse, there's been this subfield on child perpetrators, right?
Right.
I mean, there's focusing on kids who abuse other kids, right?
Right.
And so that's become a kind of growth industry. Do you see the same thing with these, you know, murderers or whatever, or, you know, mass shooters or whatever? You think there'll be a whole, you know, science or industry to come? You'll be grants to study these people, but you don't think there's enough of them?
It's going to be an ugly industry if it goes the way it's going now, because everybody has just basically got their theory and are trying to beat the drum for it.
Yeah.
Most
yeah.
of which is it's probably violent video games, and so
right
now they're searching the Santee kid's hard drive to see whether he's got a violent video game on there or what they can blame it on.
Or some chat room discussion on, you know, whatever that he was in or something.
Right.
Yeah. It's probably a mad rush to download all the things off Napster before they shut it down. You know, that probably pushed them over the edge. They're in such a rush.
Yeah.
There's a rush to superficiality that's going on right now. And you know, I think we're moving backwards in terms of our interest in understanding this. It's mainly what theory can you push. Do you think society is too permissive? You think we're giving all these oddball groups too many rights? That's the theory of Kay Heimowitz of the Manhattan Institute. Or James Garbarino, who thinks it's dark adolescent culture that's doing this. Or, you know, the influence of the ghetto on the suburban kid. That's a big one, too.
How about maybe a push for homeschooling? You know, maybe this would say the public schools are dangerous. We have to teach them at home.
Right. No children get killed at home. We know that already. Home's the safest place. That's the thing, is there's too many interests that are on all sides
agendas.
Of the spectrum.
Too much agendas.
Too much agenda pushing.
Yeah.
And the white kid shooter is perfect for agenda pushing.
So,
like the black kid was good for pushing prison building and so police expansion.
So do you think, I mean, people are saying, oh, obviously he did it, right? I mean, everybody knows this guy did it in Santee. So what, do you think he will get a fair trial, or would they just settle out of court?
There won't be any settling out of court in a criminal case, but I guess you mean in a civil case, possibly. You know, in a criminal trial, I mean, whether he can get a fair trial, I'm not really sure. I mean, there won't be any contestation of the guilt or innocence phase, I wouldn't imagine, unless he were to claim some type of diminished capacity, and he very well might. It may just be that they really contest the penalty phase, and I'm sure there'll be a huge argument there about what ought to be done, and that's a discussion we really have to have in this country. I mean, it's a clearly disturbed kid,
it's terrible stuff,
but just like we should not be rushing to send this black kid in Florida, you know, away for the rest of his life, I'm not altogether convinced that that's going to be any better resolution for this kid, even though what he did was certainly more... certainly chosen and more volitional than what happened in Florida. You know, there's still, I think, a real serious problem with the idea of simply locking people away and throwing away the key. I'm not saying that there aren't people in the country that are dangerous enough to require that of, but I just simply think that we tend to turn to that first and not really reserve that for the worst of the worst, when there are clearly other things that could be done, not only in the case of Andy Williams, but in the case of a number of, you know, quote-unquote violent, quote-unquote predators who, you know, frankly, are not nearly the lost causes that I think we often write them off to be.
But you don't think the courtroom would be the place for a discussion of how he was picked on and, you know, get some...
They'll talk about it. It may very well be that there will be some kind of diminished capacity defense that will be introduced as a way to, if not get a not guilty verdict. I don't know what the California courts are like out there in that regard, whether there's a not guilty by reason of insanity or guilty but insane. You know, they're different standards at different states, but I mean, I'm sure that stuff will come in. I mean, any defense attorney would be foolish not to bring it in, and it may very well play some role. I'm not altogether sure and don't have a whole lot of confidence that it would be very successful. I think it's pretty unlikely that you're going to be able to find a jury, for example, that really doesn't know anything about the case. I mean, they may say they don't, and they might not have kept up with it, but that's pretty unlikely you're going to find 12 people or 6 or however many would be on a jury in that case. That are going to just say, no, I never even heard of it. And if you do, you might want to wonder where they had been, because it's been a huge story.
Well, like the OJ jury, they can bring them back, obviously. I suspect it'll be handled the way the other school shootings were, and that is settled out of plea bargained.
Right.
And I think the defense attorney is going to be very, I hate to be this ignorant, but I don't believe, I'm trying to remember if Proposition 21 brought the death penalty down to 14 or not. If it did, then basically this kid's looking at life in prison, because the only thing he can you know, he's going to have to bargain not to get the chair or not to get the death penalty.
Right, right.
If not, then there would be some bargaining room for him. But I think that basically their best chance is a plea bargain.
So he would serve his term in the rest of his life, yeah.
I think he's got a very very low chance of avoiding a life sentence on this. You know, a mass public shooting, that's, you know, I can't imagine a judge or jury letting
him out later, even on parole or anything. There's no parole, right, under this new Prop 21? I mean, there's almost no parole or something.
Oh, it's everything is diminished.
Yeah.
In fact, there's so many bad provisions, it's hard to remember all
I know. It was like 40 pages or 24 pages or something. It was huge on the back, on the, you know, when you voted.
Oh, yeah.
I'm really glad that you guys out in California are leading the way in these progressive reforms. You know, I'm here in Tennessee. I'm here in Tennessee, and I'm thinking we need to probably, you know, be thankful to live in the in the backward South days like this.
We're always ahead of everything, I suppose.
Bad, that's for sure.
But do you think, are you optimistic? I mean, I suppose there will be another shooting, obviously, right? Yeah.
This is America. I mean, I hate to be this pessimistic. There's one of these mass shootings every 10 days on average.
Wow.
Very few by kids, but mostly by white adults. And we're going to wait around until there's another one because there's so many political points to be scored off of one.
Are they mostly older adults, or are they college kids or what?
No. 40 to 40 probably the peak age for conducting a mass shooting if you're a white adult, which is also very similar to serial killers.
Yeah.
Which are also almost always white. I mean, when people want to kill at random and in quantity, they don't tend to be the most oppressed members of society, at least demographically.
Right.
Which is very—it's fascinating, and I don't think anyone's really tackled this question.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting.
I think the thin skin argument applies very well. You're not learning from an early age to deal with adversity, but still,
right?
It's weird.
It's like survivor's instincts, right? I mean, if you had to struggle all your life,
right,
you know how to cope with it. But
yeah, I mean, you learn certain coping mechanisms. Clearly, there are times when you just fall apart, and there's no doubt major health effects. I mean, I do anti-racism work around the country, and where I travel and meet with people of color, you know, people will tell you about the both emotional effect and even the health effect, the high blood pressure, the stress levels, the heart disease problems. I mean, a lot of the health issues in Black and Latino communities, in indigenous communities, in Southeast Asian communities that have high poverty rates have to do with, you know, repressing a lot of emotion, repressing a lot of anger, repressing a lot of frankly rage, stuffing emotions at having been oppressed, and that works itself out in the body. You know, most of the time I've talked to young Black men on college campuses, mostly white schools, and they'll come up to me after I speak because they can tell from what I've said that they can more or less trust me, and, you know, they don't have a whole lot of white folks to vent to, so they come to me and they tell me, you know, I've been here for 3 years and I hear stuff all the time, racist jokes, racist comments, people who think I don't belong here, and I stuff it. You know, I want to say something, but I know that if I lose control, my ass will be bounced out of here, you know, and I can't screw up. So they stuff all that, and then they tell me, look, I'm afraid that one of these days somebody's going to say something fairly innocuous. It's going to push me over the edge, and I hope not. Well, the fact is they probably won't because they know what will happen if they go off. But the point that they're having to repress all that means that while a lot of white guys, older white guys in particular, may not be able to deal with keeping it in because it's something they're not prepared to deal with or to cope with in life, you know, people of color are prepared to deal with it. But when we say deal with it, that only means they're not going to outwardly express the rage. It doesn't mean they're not going to eat themselves up inside with it. And so it's clearly got some major internal health effects.
So they internalize it.
Internalize it. And, you know, one of these things is they're really suicides. These mass public shootings, there's no intent to get away with it. These are really a form of suicide, which is very common among whites as well. The suicide rates are very low among African Americans and Hispanics.
It's like theater in a way,
like
a public spectacle.
It's the blaze of glory theory, you know.
Right, as opposed to serial killers who, you know, who do intend to get away. And of course, both are typically white guys, and they do seem to be in the same general age range, which is an interesting facet of, you know, you have two different people. I mean, one type of person basically doing two very different types of crimes that clearly are somewhat different, in that one fully intends to die, and that the other intends to get away with it as long as they possibly can. And that's probably the difference between, you know, sort of classic sociopathy. I mean, sociopaths are not going to think about consequences. They're going to assume that they can game the system, you know, for years and years and years. People like Bundy, who would be pretty much classically sociopathic, although some might disagree, but you know, the people who are these mass shooters don't really expect to get away with much of anything and don't much care. And it would be interesting to, you know, examine that. But it isn't often done. You know, there are a lot of websites dedicated to, you know, talking about serial killers and even sometimes glorifying serial killers, but not a lot of attempt to sort of figure out what is going on in people that leads to this kind of behavior.
Well, it reinforces your point that this is really something that people who are oppressed all their lives learn to deal with. They're not going to commit suicide, in a sense, by conducting a mass public shooting in which they get caught.
Right.
They may have individual enemies that they get revenge against, but they don't. And they intend to get away with it. I mean, what's a drive-by shooting except intending to get away with it?
Right.
Well, actually, on that point, it's 5 o'clock. We have to
didn't want to end on drive-by shooting.
So maybe we ponder the legacy of all this, and
right.
We'll invite you back some other time.
Great.
Thank you very much, Mike.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mike Mayles and Tim Wise.
Great.
Thank you. That was two social critics. One is a criminologist, Mike Mayles, who's been on the show before, and a UCI PhD graduate from social ecology. And the other was Tim Wise, anti-racist organizer and teacher from Tennessee. This is Subversity here on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Coming up, High Visibility with Diane Chapman. Tomorrow at UCLA at 11 o'clock, there will be a big rally over affirmative action at 11. So stay tuned. This is KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. The opinions expressed on this show are not necessarily those of the Regents of the University of California, nor the management of KUCI. This is 5 o'clock, 1 minute after 5. This is Dan Zhang signing off for Subversity.